KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. May is Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Month, where community groups, tribal leaders, and advocates highlight the disproportionate levels of violence directed at Native people. Among the events held this month was the 5th annual Poetry in the Park event in Springfield, Oregon, which was sponsored by Ilulu Theater, the University of Oregon's Native American and Indigenous Studies Department, and the university's Indigenous Women's Wellness Group. Marta Clifford is an elder of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and an organizer of the event. She says she was inspired to hang red dresses from the trees in Heron Park after seeing an installation by First Nations artist Jamie Black. Clifford says the color red is very significant.
Many tribes believe that it is the color that the spirits can see, and it is a traditional color now for this program of missing and murdered Indigenous women and people, all people.
Clifford says all of the poems shared at the event were by Native writers and artists, and most of the readers are current Native or Indigenous students at the University of Oregon. One of them, Chumia Felice, is from the Yurok tribe of California. He says the MMIW crisis hits home because he's friends with the family of Emily Risling, a UO Native student leader who went missing in the fall of 2021.
She disappeared just a few feet from my village. I know the family. I know it's definitely a lot of hurt and suffering is happening right now back home on the Yurok Reservation and the Hooper Reservations. A lot of missing people. A lot of unsolved cases, too.
One student, Erica Grenlos, is with the Colville tribe. She recited a poem titled, I Am 10 Years Old, and is about a young girl who's kidnapped, raped, and murdered by a non-Native man with, quote, the gentlest smile.
I actually cried the first time I read this because I just felt it, and like as another Native woman myself, I just really felt it in my heart. They asked me if I wanted to switch my poem, but I talked with my mom and I felt like I was strong enough today to come out here and read this poem.
Another student, Mykesha Yepa of the Hickory Apache tribe, read Helen Betty Osborne by Marilyn Dumont. It's based on the 1971 abduction and murder of a 19-year-old Cree woman. It took 16 years for her four suspected killers to be tried, with only one serving time.
The poem definitely resonated with me because the metaphor of open season and how powerful it is and how much women are preyed upon, and I guess it's like a hunting season for women.
After the final reading, an honor song was given in the memory of missing and murdered Indigenous people, as well as the friends and families affected. Roses were handed out to the participants, and people who may be grieving or otherwise affected by the MMIP crisis were invited to talk with the students. And this week is the Native Elements Arts Festival and Market at the Santa Fe Botanical Garden and Convention Center in New Mexico. 160 Native American and Indigenous artists are expected to be featured at the market. A new honor, the Native Elements Distinguished Achievement Award, will be presented. The event will benefit the Botanical Garden, the Institute of American Indian Art Scholarship Fund, and the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org.
Support by Arctic Encounter, North America's largest Arctic policy event at the Dena'ina Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. Registration for this global dialogue at arcticencounter.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It also drives some accountability in some of the government programs that are safety net programs.
Alaska Congressman Nick Begich votes for a budget bill that cuts funding for Medicaid and food stamps. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 22nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Ukrainian refugees work as home builders amid a nationwide shortage of affordable housing.
Everybody who comes here, they looking forward for that better life, you know, and this is what America provides.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University's Master's in Outdoor and Environmental Education prepares you to create lasting change. In 2 years, you can earn your degree, gain hands-on experience, and graduate with no tuition debt. Study with expert faculty and leaders in outdoor recreation, place-based education, and community tourism. Learn more at OutdoorEducationAlaska.com or text 907-982-3122. This message sponsored by APU.
Without a single vote to spare, the U.S. House passed a mega bill early this morning that's chock full of Republican priorities. It includes tax cuts, oil development in Alaska's Arctic, and cuts to Medicaid and food assistance for needy families. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Like nearly all Republicans, Alaska Congressman Nick Begich voted for the budget reconciliation bill, now officially titled the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
This is a great bill for Alaska. It preserves the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, so it keeps taxes low for working Americans, working Alaskans. It also drives some accountability in some of the government programs that are safety net programs.
Critics say the bill is devastating for the social safety net. Nationally, the budget reconciliation bill cuts almost $100 billion a year from Medicaid, a public health insurance program, and SNAP, sometimes called food stamps. It shifts some of those costs to the states. If it becomes law, states for the first time would have to pay a percentage of SNAP benefits based on each state's rate of payment error. That would hit particularly hard in Alaska, which has the highest error rate in the country, stemming from a huge backlog in cases it struggled to clear. Alaska could be on the hook for 25% of SNAP benefits, or $63 million. Also, the bill would cut in half the amount the federal government pays the states to administer SNAP, a loss of nearly $6 million for Alaska.
We're struggling right now, and this would just be a bigger hit.
State Representative Genevieve Mina, an Anchorage Democrat, chairs the State House Committee on Health and Social Services.
I still receive constituent emails and emails from people in other districts that they've been waiting months for their Medicaid and for their SNAP. So it's this cascading impact.
About 1 in 10 Alaskans receive SNAP benefits to help them buy food. The program injects some $250 million a year into Alaska's economy through grocery purchases. State House Representative Zach Fields, another Anchorage Democrat, says there's no quick way to fix Alaska's difficulty administering the federal programs. Fields attributes the problem to worker vacancies, low salaries, and skimpy benefits.
This is such a profound challenge. It's absolutely not something we can solve by the time these proposed mandates and the budget reconciliation proposal would come down on us.
Congressman Begich says he supports measures to ensure Alaska and other states abide by the rules of the safety net programs. He notes that Alaska's cost share of SNAP could drop from 25% to 5% if it improves its error rate.
A number of other states have gotten it right, and I think that we need to look to other states for how we go about ensuring that the people that are receiving the benefit are properly vetted.
The bill includes a wide array of Republican priorities. It would require new oil lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and in Cook Inlet. House leaders at the last minute dropped a section to promote development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. They also removed a section approving the Ambler Road. The reconciliation bill goes next to the Senate, where it can pass with just Republican votes, but several Republicans have said they don't like it. Senator Lisa Murkowski has said she won't vote for a bill that makes big cuts to health care coverage. She says a bill that does that indirectly by requiring states to contribute more than they can isn't good either.
If you shift these costs and they are substantial enough, you will quite possibly have the state in the position of then just dropping those individuals from the rolls.
Murkowski says she's still studying the bill for its Alaska impacts. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaskans have staged two demonstrations over the past 2 days to protest Alaska Congressman Nick Begich's support for Medicaid cuts in the National Budget Reconciliation Bill. Demonstrators gathered outside Begich's Anchorage office before and after his vote for what they described as devastating Medicaid cuts. Organizers say the protest this afternoon was to express public mourning for Begich's vote. The demonstrators staged a hospital bed and funeral flowers to show that the cuts could mean the difference between life and death for some Alaskans. Sarah and Zachary Krug were among the 50 Alaskans at today's protest. Sarah says her son Zachary has cerebral palsy and relies on Medicaid.
It's literally been a lifesaver for him from day one. I worked three jobs to make ends meet. What do you think about them cutting Medicaid?
I need my meds.
You need your meds.
Emily Dott of Alaska Caregivers Union helped rally the protesters with a pink megaphone. She says Alaskans are not going to let their politicians rip away health care from thousands.
If all of you here who rely on Medicaid, it's all of your family and friends, whose lives are at risk because of what Nick Begich did last night.
Dott says because the bill goes to the Senate next, Alaskans still have a chance to help stop it. Organizers called for Alaskans to pressure Senator Dan Sullivan next. Organizers say they feel more confident Senator Lisa Murkowski will not support major Medicaid cuts. Over 100 Ukrainian refugees have settled in the small interior town of Delta Junction. Many work in trades like construction and occupy an underfilled niche in the state's workforce. But their future is uncertain after the Trump administration suspended the programs that brought them to the United States earlier this year. The Alaska Desk's Shelby Herbert brings us the final installment of a two-part series about what's ahead for the region's growing Slavic community.
Dennis Hatman is the owner of Prudent Builders, a small construction company in Delta Junction. He immigrated to the United States decades ago from Kazakhstan by way of Latvia, and he's deeply embedded in the area's Slavic culture. Hatman employs several Ukrainians to build new houses all over town. He walks me through one such house in progress as his workers are putting down the finishing touches.
So we got master room here. Almost getting done, and then a bathroom upstairs.
In the corner, one of his workers, Alexei Butenko, is sanding down a wooden doorframe. Butenko fled Ukraine with his wife and seven children after Russia invaded the country back in 2022. They joined relatives who were already living in Delta Junction. He says when the war came, they left everything. They didn't sell anything. His brother always told him that life is better in America and that he'd find mountains of gold. That's his wife, Natalie, reminding him that he didn't find that gold right away. Just a lot of trees. Workers from Ukraine, like Butenko, are filling much-needed jobs in Alaska. Many of them work in construction, building homes in the middle of a state and nationwide housing crunch. But their future employment is in jeopardy after the Trump administration suspended programs that were supporting their stay earlier this year. Butenko worked in construction back in Ukraine. He met his boss, Hatman, through church. Khatmin says his Ukrainian employees add a lot to his business and the local economy.
They work hard. They will do any job. Everybody wants to grow. Everybody wants to have a house or land or a new car or, you know. So they're willing to work and willing to do things that I guess some people don't care or that some people don't want to do it.
All of that hard work comes as the state is experiencing a major affordable housing shortage. Chris Kolarok is a policy advisor with the Cook Inlet Housing Authority. He says communities across the state are reaching critical mass. Alaska needs to build or renovate about 28,000 housing units to meet current demand, according to data from 2023.
And when you think through the population of the state of Alaska, that's quite a lot per capita. We've only been building about between 10 and 25% of the homes needed to keep up with population growth and natural decay of homes.
At the same time, demand for the people who can build those houses is also booming. Karina Wiebold is an economist with the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development. She says more people are leaving Alaska, and the state struggles to attract working-age adults. She says construction jobs are soaring across the board, including the kind of residential contracting work Dennis Khatmin does. Take last year.
We saw 1,400 new jobs, and average annual wages increased another 9%. Again, showing that this is a high-demand industry where they're really looking at attracting new workers.
Meanwhile, Khatmin says he'll just keep building houses, and he hopes his friends and employees get to continue their pursuit of the American dream safely away from the war zone.
You know, and I think everybody who comes here, they're looking forward for that better life, you know, and this is what America provides. He's like, you know, hey, you want to work, you will get it. So that's where we are here. We want to, you know, to raise up America and have a better life.
And Butenko says, through all the confusion and precarity, he's just focusing on his faith and family and putting down roots. With reporting help from Elyona Nyden, I'm Shelby Herbert in Delta Junction.
That was the final part in a two-part series from the Alaska Desk about the Ukrainian community in Delta Junction. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students and teachers in Kotzebue unearth a time capsule from 25 years ago.
This was a big deal. The whole millennium change was just momentous for us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
An Anchorage lawyer has been implicated as a, quote, cartel attorney working for traffickers who allegedly sent hard drugs from Mexico to Alaska. Federal authorities on Wednesday arrested 44-year-old Justin Facey on charges that he maintained a drug-involved premises and had firearms in connection with drug trafficking. A court filing in the case says Facey was addicted to methamphetamine supplied by the traffickers, four of whom were indicted in the 2023 murder of two women found in Trapper Creek. More than 60 people have been indicted as part of the larger conspiracy. Prosecutors have described it as a veritable pipeline of meth, fentanyl, heroin, and cocaine headed to Alaska dealers and ultimately street-level users. According to federal prosecutors' court filing Wednesday, Facey bragged to other lawyers about working for the traffickers and said he'd been able to afford a bigger office space on 8th Avenue in downtown Anchorage. In one instance, the filing says, Facey helped the gang's leader plot how to smuggle a member of the trafficking group out of Alaska after they'd nearly been arrested by Anchorage police. Facey also allegedly suggested a way to launder money. The filing also includes interviews with people Facey represented as their defense attorney. One woman said he had coerced her for sex acts as payment for his legal representation. The Alaska Bar Association in February suspended Facey from practicing law in Alaska after numerous complaints. He made an initial court appearance in the case today. An attorney appointed to represent him declined to comment. City of Anchorage has reached a financial settlement with the family of a teenager shot and killed by police last summer. The city paid over $2 million to the family of Easter Liafa. Liafa was 16 years old when she was shot and killed by Anchorage police at her home on August 13th. Officers had received a 911 call from a family member who said Liafa was threatening others with a knife. Police body camera footage of the incident showed Liafa walking from a balcony into the home while holding a kitchen knife. As she stepped into the apartment towards officers, she was shot and died on the scene. State prosecutors later ruled that the officer who shot Liafa was legally justified. Liafa's shooting was the sixth of eight police shootings last year and prompted widespread community outrage. In response, Mayor Suzanne LaFrance's administration hired a third-party investigator to look into the shooting. Later, the mayor announced a series of reforms, including reviews of the training police officers undergo during the police academy and a review of the last 15 years of police shootings. In a statement released after the settlement, the Liafa family wrote, quote, "Mayor LaFrance and Chief Case heard us and committed to trying to make our community safer by looking deeply at not only this tragic event, but also by examining in general police policies on training and implementation of best practices in the community," end quote. The city released the third-party review of the shooting and the broader review of police shootings in November and January. The city is currently working to hire a contractor to review the police department's use of force and de-escalation policies. This year, Anchorage police have shot five people, killing three of them. In one of those cases, Anchorage police say a man shot and killed by officers last Monday had a felony warrant for a stolen vehicle and was not legally allowed to have the gun officers found in his possession. But that's not why officers approached him. That's according to Police Chief Sean Case, who released new information at a news conference today about the fatal shooting of Otuva Alealua. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early was there and has this story.
Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case says that on the night of May 13th, Officer Carter Mays was monitoring a vehicle parked near an apartment complex in North Mountain View. Case said the vehicle was associated with a man who had a felony warrant for weapons misconduct. Then a second vehicle parked nearby, driven by Alealua.
He observed that vehicle stop in the area of the vehicle he was monitoring. And some people came and went from that vehicle, and then the vehicle drove off towards the officer.
Case said Alealua's vehicle had a headlight issue, so Mays, the officer, went to pull it over. A second police officer in the area parked in front of Alealua's vehicle, Case said, and there was a female passenger in the vehicle as well. Case said Mays had a brief discussion with Alealua, telling him why he was pulled over and asking Alealua if he had a firearm in the vehicle. Alealua said he didn't. During the news conference, Case pointed to photos taken from police body camera footage.
Our involved officer on the passenger side asks the driver to get out of the car. The officer on the driver's side opens up the door. The officer on the driver's side observes a gun, and he immediately closes the door.
Case said officers asked Alealua to put his hands up, and he initially complied with the commands. When officers asked Alealua to exit the vehicle, Case said he put one of his hands down.
What you will see in the video is the hand, the left hand of the driver, drop down towards that gun. The officer fired one round, and the subject was pronounced deceased on scene.
Case declined to speculate on whether it's possible Alealua had been lowering his left hand to open the car door rather than reaching for the gun.
I'll hold off on answering that just because I think it'll be clear later on when more information is put out exactly what the officer saw because of the clear view that he had.
Case said Alealua was not legally allowed to own a firearm and had a felony warrant for a stolen vehicle. Alealua is the fifth person shot by Anchorage police this year and the third to die as a result. Last year, Anchorage police shot eight people, killing five of them. So far, all officers involved in these shootings have been cleared of wrongdoing by state prosecutors. Asked about the high number of police shootings during a separate news conference on public safety held Tuesday morning, Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance said her administration is working to make sure the police are trained properly to handle high-pressure situations.
Since we've taken office, the chief has been focused on reviewing APD, and we have an RFP to a third party that will conduct a review of APD's policies, procedures, training. Our focus is again on ensuring that everyone in the public is safe and we take our job of public safety very seriously.
During the same news conference, Case expressed dismay that a person was killed during a traffic stop, both from an officer's and the public's perspective.
From any way that you look at a traffic stop that results in any use of force or significant use of force, whether you're a member of the public or a member of the police department, it's always concerning. I mean, think about an officer going to a traffic stop with the intent of probably writing a ticket, and that turns into a larger incident.
Case says APD is wrapping up its investigation of Alea Lewis' killing and will then pass off the investigation to the Office of Special Prosecutions. Police will release the body camera footage once the state completes its review. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Don't wait 24 hours to report a missing person. As soon as you suspect someone is missing, call your local law enforcement or 911 to make a report. Be ready to provide as much descriptive information as possible to help locate your friend, family member, or loved one. Your reporting can make all the difference, and maybe even save a life. Learn more about Alaska's Village Public Safety Officers at vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Village Public Safety Officer Program.
The number of businesses that manufacture products in Alaska is small, but a new association hopes to change that. Alaska Manufacturing Association is building a business directory in an effort to make it easier for businesses to produce products locally. Megan Militello is the association's managing partner. She says the directory will connect businesses with manufacturers and find solutions to common problems.
This is people that are invested into manufacturing in Alaska. You know, it's like we just got to get into a space where we can make some changes actually happen. Like, very action-driven is the goal with the directory.
High shipping costs are a major hurdle for Alaska manufacturers. Militello says businesses can get creative to save some cash by combining freight. Another challenge is finding adequate staffing, she says, which many business owners are experiencing. Militello used to own Elevated Oats, an Anchorage-based oat and granola company. Manufacturing in Alaska, she says, gave her insight into the challenges businesses face when it comes to manufacturing locally and the opportunities.
You're not really able to just find other people making things that you may need. I think that we can have people that really rely on each other and can support each other's businesses more than I'm going to this marketing agency that's in the lower 48.
A major resource for local manufacturers will close next month. The Alaska Manufacturing Partnership provides training, technical assistance, and development opportunities to manufacturers across the state, but that organization is shutting down at the end of June. Militello says the new association will fill the gap.
We're doing something completely different, which is bringing the power to the people, not just consulting or giving you a connection to a vendor that can help you out. It's like, how can I just get you guys in the same space together?
She says there are more products manufactured in Alaska than many people realize, from machines for airline runway cleaning to tortillas and alcohol-infused cookies. Students, teachers, and community members gathered at Kotzebue's Elementary School last week to open a time capsule sealed 25 years ago. As KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, the capsule unlocked Y2K-era artifacts and memories.
About 300 people pack into the bleachers at June Nelson Elementary School on a Friday afternoon. The crowd is a mix of students, teachers, and former students, now in their 30s. A 3-foot-tall metal cylinder rests on a table in front of the assistant principal, Corey Shepherd.
It was my hope to do something like this where we could invite community members and our current students and as many people who may have been part of this to see its unveiling 25 years later.
Shepherd carefully twists off the metal lid and removes each item. Inside the capsule are maps and photos of Kotzebue, a blank floppy disk, papers from students. There's even a toothbrush. Shepherd also pulls a Beanie Baby from the capsule. but it's the year 2000's most popular toy that receives a huge reaction from the crowd. It's a Furby, the fluffy, owl-like robot that speaks its own language, called Furbish. There's enough items to fill three folding tables with trinkets and papers. Soon the gym is mostly empty, except for former students that participated in the project 25 years ago, sorting through yearbook photos and writing samples. Veronica Ferguson is one of those former students. She reads a writing sample from her brother that was inside the capsule.
My name is Nicholas Ferguson. I am 8 years old. I am in the second grade. When I grow up, I want to be a firefighter. And he sure was.
He became a firefighter?
Yep.
Wow.
He was a lieutenant, I think. And then my brother Tristan was chief.
Reed Magdance, a elementary student at the time, says he wasn't really surprised about the capsule's contents. That is, until he noticed a script from a play he was in.
There's me in the play.
And what?
Come Live With Me, an Arctic play. I was a Wolverine. This play had a VHS recording. I had no idea that existed.
Faith Jers is a teacher and remembers the time capsule project. Now she teaches many of the children of the students that contributed to the capsule.
This was a big deal. The whole millennium change was just momentous for us.
Jers remembers the play in the time capsule and helped produce and film it.
We wrote this. This, the Talented and Gifted program. We wrote this, we did the sets, we did the costumes. Super cute, adorable.
Jers says the play is about a little boy who brings a bug inside his room. After noticing the bug is lonely, he brings in more and more animals to keep them company. The elementary students wrote the script, and high school students designed the set with movable mountains and landscapes. Assistant Principal Shepherd says that is one of his takeaways from the time capsule.
Really just goes to show the state of funding for our schools, and that's, you know, why our teachers now have to take on such a role of advocacy to really fight for those resources that help us do those things that make school memorable, those things that are worthy of putting in a time capsule.
Shepherd says the capsule is more than artifacts. It's about connecting students with the past and how they will shape the future.
What will we place in the next time capsule? What do we hope future students will remember about us? Let's make sure we keep building a school and a community that they will be proud to inherit.
Shepherd says the school plans to continue the time capsule in the future. He says he hopes to digitize some of the materials and share them to the school's website and Facebook page. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Cassandra, Wesley Early, and Ava White in Anchorage, Shelby Herbert in Delta Junction, and Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
the good Lord be with you down every road you roam. And may sunshine and happiness surround you when you're far from home. And may you grow to be proud, dignified and true. And do unto others as you'd have done to you. Be courageous and be brave, and in my heart you'll always stay forever young. Be with you, may your guiding light be strong. Build a stairway to heaven with a prince or a vagabond. And may you never love in vain, and in my heart you'll always remain forever. Thank you.
Went to the station, didn't see no train. Down in the hall, I have an aching pain. How long, how long, baby, how long? I feel disgusted, I feel so bad, thinking about the good time that I once had. How long, baby, how long? I could see the green grass growing on the hill. I ain't seen no green though on a dollar bill. How long? How long? Baby, how long? You're gonna be sorry. You feel so blue. When you won't be, baby, I declare I won't want you. How long? How long? Baby, how long? Don't have no money or to ride the train. I would ride the rods, baby, to be with you again. How long? How long? Baby, how long? How long? Baby, how long? Must I keep my watching call? How long? How long? Baby, how long?
Shawnee's the one for you to be with. But when I'm caught all alone, I start start testing. It's from state of depression. And then the thunder clouds of doubt move in. I begin to wonder, do you still love me? But after that, my whole world is beautiful.
Jump! 69 Oldsmobile, and I wanna know what they're not telling.